My name is Jeff Harbach. I'm the CEO of Coffin Fellows and the host of the Coffin Fellows podcast. This season, our podcast is produced in partnership with Mighty Capital and features different Coffin Fellows as co-hosts. In this podcast, we dive deep into the personal narratives of some of the most successful names in the venture capital industry. But we're not here just to explore their highlight reels, however impressive they are. From failures and formative learning experiences to inflection points and aha moments, we discuss the real, authentic journeys that each individual goes through to become the best version of themselves in order to best serve the entrepreneurs they invest in. Covering various themes in venture capital investing, we speak with the world's top leaders in capital formation, all from a place of authenticity and vulnerability. Together, we'll unravel what truly makes a great venture capital investor. Now let's meet today's host and their guest.
Welcome to the Venture is Human show. I'm your host, Mohamed Almeshika, founder and managing partner of Outliers Capital. In this show, I converse with thought leaders in the venture and investing world to unpack the human side of investing and company building. If you're a founder or an investor, you already know that investing is fundamentally a people's business. I explore that further with our guest today. Hey, Ken, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mo. Great to be here.
Great to have you, Ken. So let's get right to it. You've been identified by MarketWatch as one of the most connected people in the technology space. Would love to get your thoughts on how important you think networking is for founders and investors in the ecosystem.
So my sense is that networking isn't for everyone, but for me, this is my one superpower. So I think that each founder and each venture investor needs to figure out what they can do better than almost anybody else in the field. And if a founder is really good at networking, it can lead to huge success. Because as you know, the biggest issues that startups have are recruiting the right people. So networking plays right into that. It's also getting your first three marquee customers if you're an enterprise B2B company. And a lot of that has to do with proper networking and so on. And same on the VC side. You know, the toughest part about being in venture is sourcing high quality deals. And one way to source high quality deals is to have a great network that gives back to you, that refers high quality deals to you. But there's other ways to source high quality deals. You could be an expert in a space and just be extremely well known in your own right in that respect.
So when you say networking is not for everyone, so do you think a founder and investor can be successful without having the ability to network and build relationships and long-term relationships?
I think it depends on what type of team the founder has created, because I think every team needs to be holistic across many different skill sets. So you need to have a team that's extremely technical, that can understand how to read market trends and come up with differentiation. But also, at least one person on that team should be able to network, because you're going to need that capability to bring in the best people into the company to get the right initial conversations with customers. And same thing with partnerships. I think in partnerships, you should have a diverse group of partners, and some of them can be really good in some areas and some of them can be really good in other areas, like networking, as this example.
And networking is more of a means to an end, right? Like, so the whole idea is to build deep relationships that are built on trust, either with your team, your first hires, your co-founders, your investors. How do you think about trust, and how do you, as an investor, when you look at founding teams, how do you measure that trust between existing founders, and how do you build long-term trust with those founding teams for the success of the company and the partnership?
Yeah, you know, I'll correct one thing that you said. You said that networking is a means to an end. I don't think that networking is a means to an end. If you think about networking in that way, you're doing it for something in return. And to do really good networking, one shouldn't be thinking about it that way. It's to what you said, it's all about building trust and building a deep relationship. And then if you are giving more to the next person then they will hopefully give you back something in return over some period of time. But it's not like there's a scorecard that's out there. And I also think that that dovetails into exactly your question is building trust. The only way to build trust is to, in my mind, be able to give more in the relationship than the other person's giving you at that point in time. And then obviously over time, if that person is a good person, they'll find ways to help you down the line. And it could be, you know, 1 week down the line, or it could be one decade down the line. Some of my, you know, best deals have come with and from relationships that have been over multiple decades.
Interesting. So maybe it's a good time to maybe like define networking, because the way that I thought about it when it's a means to an end, it's the act of having conversations with people. You have conversation not just for the sake of conversation, but for exchange of value and relationship. So that is more of the end results. The networking itself, I took the more maybe simplistic view of like mingling, talking, spending some time. Would love to get your thoughts on how you think about networking. What defines a good networker, and how can they build that relationship?
Well, I think that each person, if you're an investor, hopefully you have a area of expertise, either a space that you're very interested in or a stage that you're extremely interested in. And therefore, your networking job becomes a little bit easier because it creates a smaller pond and it makes it a lot more intimate. And networking, to your point, is about sharing ideas, getting to know people. But from a business sense, it's the next step after that. How do you cultivate that relationship so that over time there is a give and take with every, you know, person in your network that's positive for both sides? If it's not, then you're not a very good networker.
Yeah, no, that's great. I love the give and take, and I think it's always like a, you know, Adam Grant book is phenomenal in that aspect. Just kind of like moving a little bit on thinking about, you know, the trust and the trust between founding teams. You've backed companies that have five people in the founding teams, and you've backed companies that have, you know, far more less founding team. How do you assess, you know, those founding teams? What do you look for? What are sort of some questions that they need to figure out as co-founders for a long-lasting relationship before going out and fundraising and building a company? Would love to get your perspective on that.
Yeah, putting together the right founding team is probably the most important first step in terms of starting a company. And ideally, the founding team coming together is extremely natural. And the reason that that's important is because, as you know, every startup goes through ups and downs, and that tension is absolutely normal. And what you want is a founding team that can bob and weave with each other and help each other. And sometimes if you have one founder who's very business oriented and one founder who's very technical oriented, sometimes the business side is not going well, and that technical founder needs to help the business founder, not push that business founder down, because that's when companies break apart. Ideally, you know, the founding team has one person who is nominated as the CEO, because in terms of getting things done, at the end of the day, someone needs to take responsibility for that. You can still, you know, share the economics completely equitably, or you could make the person in charge, you know, have slightly more economics. But in terms of making decisions, it's really hard to make tough decisions if you have an even number of founders that have equal votes.
No, that's a great point. And I wanted to double click on that a little bit with you. I've seen some investors ask founders, how do you fire each other? Or how do you make a decision when there's a deadlock? From your like over two decades of experience, one, do you think that's a fair question to ask? Two, is what do you found the best practices in managing those dynamics as humans in a founding team?
So So from an investor's point of view, there always needs to be a mechanism for changing the founding team. You know, unfortunately, not 100% of the companies always go up and to the right. And maybe, you know, a founder doesn't want to work hard anymore, or maybe a founder has outgrown his or her skill sets. So there needs to be a mechanism to make that work. So that's, you know, completely a fair question if I was an investor in a founding team. And I think the founders should think about that as well, because they should predict that there's going to be some great times in the company, and they should be predicting that there's going to be some super tough times in the company moving forward.
And like, how do they think about that as, what do you see best practices in, you know, maybe one of the founders grows with the company, but then they see their co-founder kind of like, you know, wanting to stay at a certain place. Is there some mechanisms that those founders should institute in place to make sure that doesn't affect the longevity or the success of the company?
Yeah, the best practices that I have seen is that most companies have an exec staff meeting with the entire VP level and above. And it's a pretty structured meeting where each group is giving updates and also discusses what they need from all of the other groups. And then after that, typically the founders will get together because they're the decision-making body and answer any tough questions that they have on what the team is asking for. But that's also the right time for these founders to discuss issues that they have with each other, because there's nothing worse than being in a company when you can see two founders not getting along or disagreeing on things. And sometimes it cannot be resolved. And that's when, you know, the best practices that I've seen is that you go get some outside help. So there's CEO coaches and executive coaches that can help you get through this. And ideally, the founders would have already brought on these executive coaches over a longer period of time, not once they've hit the wall with a bunch of issues with each other. And I think that's what venture investors can do as well, is they can bring in one of these high quality coaches early on to help the CEO or the other co-founder voice their concerns in a safe environment.
I think you've raised a great point around coaching, and maybe it's a good segue to think about kind of like the relationship that exists with, you know, teams and potentially their coaches and investors around in a Zoom virtual world, like in a Zoom first world. How do you assess and evaluate? How have your process changed? You know, when you're evaluating a company where like it's mostly Zoom discussions, not a lot of face-to-face interactions. And did your process change at all? Did you introduce new things, new checks? You know, I heard you comment on a couple of things around, you know, founders getting their own family members involved sometimes accidentally, kids jumping on, or, you know, coworkers or colleagues. So we'd love to get your thoughts on how you've thought about this and improved your process and ability to assess those founders.
Yeah, the Zoom culture in some ways has been phenomenally great, because I think that we are all immensely more efficient. I mean, we're all stacked back to back. There's not as much travel time. At the same time, this venture business and startup business is all about people and interactions and relationships. And that is harder to establish over Zoom. So ideally, we still would get together face-to-face in some sort of way and go for a social distance hike. And we have done that in the past for almost all of our companies. And when that wasn't possible, we do what we always do, which is do a ton of background checks on the founders and understand their strengths and weaknesses. While you won't get all of the complete body expression and understand, you know, what their, you know, certain proclivities of potential issues that are going to happen at the company or between their team, you still get the vast majority of that. So, like I said, it's been amazingly efficient, but we do need to spend a lot of time, if you're doing it over Zoom, getting third-party recognition on every candidate as well as every founder.
And this is like a two-way partnership, right? Like, you know, I've always told every founder that we work with that we do diligence, kind of like the process and the company and the team, and they have to do diligence their investors. And you talked about how an investor would do due diligence like a company. So how would you advise a founder right now talking to an investor in a virtual first world in due diligencing that investor? You know, is it the proper partnership for them and whether that's a good fit?
Yeah, so I have a couple ideas on this. One is actions speak louder than words. So in normal circumstances, during a due diligence process, the venture investor should be showing the value that they can add to a portfolio company. So they can open up a door to a customer or a partner. In this day and age, deals are moving super fast, and you may not be able to open up a door as quickly as you want. But that really is the best way for a founder to test a venture firm, is to understand where they are best of breed in terms of, you know, hiring or opening up doors at a customer or partner and testing it out. And if the venture partner can't deliver, at least you know what you're getting into. And then obviously the second thing is that every founder that we invest in, we encourage that they call other founders in our portfolio. We can either tee it up or they can go contact them on their own. That I think is an important part of the process. Because the way that I think about the startup process is that it is like you're entering a marriage. I mean, most of these startups are going to last over 7 years, which is longer than the average marriage in the United States.
100%. It's definitely a marriage in every sense of the world, in terms of you know, the impact that it would have in you and your future and the length and duration. And it's just a long journey with true partnership. Want to switch gear a little bit on some of the traits that I know you're very passionate about, especially consistency. It's something that you said once that in your over two decades of experience in the venture space, consistency has been one of the top traits that you see in investors and also in founders and you value a lot. Can you elaborate on that a little bit, unpack what do you mean by consistency, and also how do you measure that consistency when you explore a new opportunity, you know, business relationship and you know, founding team?
Well, consistency means different things in different situations. What I mean by consistency is that we typically have types of deals that we are very good at investing in. So if you're a seed and Series A investor, like we are at Sorensen Ventures, or you're a growth investor, you need to understand what you're really good at and where you can add value. Same thing with spaces. I focus a lot on security. My partner, Rob, focuses a lot on enterprise software and identity. So those are spaces where you can become an expert. And there's always subspaces and new areas that dovetail off of those core spaces where you can reinvent yourself, but it's reinventing off of a consistent base core area. So hopefully that makes sense. And then also in the types of companies that have been successful, there is a pattern. There is a pattern of you getting your first few customers and then stepping on the gas and proving through metrics and productivity analyses, when is the time to step on the gas even more. And I think that when you're not consistent in terms of what you're looking for in terms of success, that's where you can get over your skis and you are doing more hoping and praying than, you know, consistent investing.
You touched upon a great point here in milestones and metrics and productivity analysis. Financial metrics are always, you know, much easier to think, to plan, to project, to kind of like figure out a path and measure objectively where you are. How do you think about non-financial metrics like team and team quality and first hires and kind of like all of those things and elements that are very critical to the success of a company. How do you go about advising your portfolio companies to think about and you assess when you're evaluating opportunities?
Yeah, I mean, every company can manage this in a different way, but obviously the CEO has overall metrics of what they're trying to achieve. And then each part of their organization has different goals that they're trying to achieve. So there's some sales goals, there's some marketing goals, and there's some engineering goals. And each one of those groups should have their goals for the quarter, for the year, and for multiple years. And some of those goals are not going to be measurable through financial statistics. What we need to do is we need to set up what we are trying to accomplish at the beginning of the quarter, and then report on what actually happened at the end of the quarter or at the end of the year. But if you don't set it up correctly at the beginning, you won't have, even though it's not numerical, you won't have the kind of the touch and feel of whether we're accomplishing it or not. And that's the only way that you can really see how you're progressing on these non-metrics oriented but important items for the company. The problem that most companies have is they try and look in the rearview mirror and either say that they were successful or not successful, but you don't know what the thesis was at the beginning. You know, for example, you know, you could as a company say that you're focused on enterprise sales, or you could say that you're focused on product-led growth and you want to make a decision on which area to put more wood behind the arrow on by Q3. That is a measurable decision. And maybe the decision at the end of Q3 is to push off the decision for another two quarters because you're still experimenting. But at least you put, you know, a stake in the ground in terms of what you want to try to accomplish at the beginning of the year.
Thank you for sharing that. That's really interesting. It's always like you can't measure what you can define, and it doesn't have to be always quantitative. It could be like you set an objective and look back and say, have we done what we said we gotta do, and not always just look in the mirror without predefining what you want to achieve. So I think that's a great way to put it.
And I think that the smartest teams can lay out by group what their thesis is, not necessarily have it backed up by numbers, but what their thesis is and by what date they're going to either have strong conviction on that thesis or that they're going to kick out that thesis and come up with a new thesis. So that, I think, is the important way to evolve the thinking.
That's great. Just kind of like switching a little bit of a gear here around thesis. You brought in the word, and it's an overloaded word. I want to take it from a different angle is, there's a lot of investors that say we're thesis-driven investors, and we have a certain thesis, we go after it, and we just go and find the company that executes on it and back them. And then you have investors who are, you know, they say like we're team-driven investors. We're going to just find the best team. Whatever those teams do, we're just going to go and back them. How would you define your approach, and what are your thoughts on, you know, either of those approaches, and you kind of like your perspective on them?
Well, it's a great question. I'd say at Sorensen Ventures, we're very thesis-driven because we only focus on security and enterprise software. And in each one of those areas, each of us have a couple of majors and a couple of minors, and we try and rotate the majors and minors and bring in new majors and minors every quarter. And what we try and do is we try and speak with the top 20 or 30 companies in and around those spaces. And sometimes as you do that, you get pushed down different branches that you did not expect. And then you find a sub branch that you think is super interesting. So we spend a ton of time on that. And then just like how you talked about at the beginning, we're very relationship driven. And we obviously, since both Rob and myself have been investing for about 22 years apiece, we have a lot of entrepreneurs that we've built relationships over time. And obviously when they start a company, they come our way. But what's really cool is that when they have entrepreneur friends that are starting companies, we get great referrals And sometimes the people that they've mentored, whether it's a VP product management or CTO starts company, we get referrals through that. And so that ball, you know, continues to get stronger and stronger over time. And what we also try and do is we try and reach out to every high quality entrepreneur that has sold their company in security or enterprise software to get to know them. Because typically, most entrepreneurs that sell their companies to larger companies like starting new companies after a couple of years. So we have a process around that as well.
That's great. I love how productizing, you know, talent hunting and early stage discovery of companies will pick up this and this tidbit from you. You just said you've been, you know, more than two decades investing, and you've seen a lot of cycles, successful ups and downs, the 2000-2008. What are the most common bad recommendation that you see during those cycles that are floating into the ecosystem that you would say, you know, although that you might hear this a lot, but this is something that you've seen from your experience that is not either not true or is not that important?
Well, there is lots of warning signs that I'm seeing today that I saw back in early 2000 and in 2008 before each one of those downturns. The biggest thing is that we have way too many companies in subspaces going after the same problem. And as you know, the top company is going to take the rewards in those spaces. And maybe the number two or number three will make some money for the founders and for the investors. But the vast majority of these companies are not going to do well. And unfortunately, I think that a lot of the theses around, you know, these companies that are number four and below don't really stick on what their real differentiation is. So there's way, way too much noise in the market and too much money going after too few deals. The second thing is that a lot of the companies, in my mind, are spending way too much money for their stage of maturity. And what will happen is that when capital is not as easy to get, you're going to see that a lot of these companies that have $2 or $3 million burn rates are not going to be able to bring down those burn rates. So I would much rather work with companies that set up goals and understand when to step on the gas over time. And then, you know, the other mistake that I see is that there's entrepreneurs that are moving, you know, from consumer to enterprise or from enterprise to consumer because they think that it's a little bit easier on the other side of the fence. And that is never the case. I think it's the best entrepreneurs that understand the domain that they're going after are the ones that are going to win. So those are some of the mistakes that I see right now, as well as just the overvaluation on deals. While this is very enticing for founders, and honestly, if I was a founder, I would probably want to take in more money. But with that comes extremely high expectations. And unfortunately, when you don't hit your goals and can raise the valuation by at least 2x by the next round, you know, then you're going to start seeing more of these down rounds, and that's when companies get pulled apart.
So thank you for sharing all of that. As a concluding remarks, from your own experience, what do you think makes the best investor? What defines a great investor?
Well, I don't think that there's one unicorn type of investor. I think it all depends on what the company needs and the makeup of the founders. But what I will say is that at the very early stages where Thornton Ventures focuses, which is at the seed or Series A, I think that our expertise in looking at product and understanding that products are super important for getting the product market fit is a key part of it. And then two is our value add in terms of opening up doors at customers and partners. So at the very early stages of companies, I think that is absolutely critical. That's what I would look for.
So a great investor would be someone at an early stage, help, you know, look at the product, support the companies on the product, and add value by connecting them with potential customers. Would you say that would be kind of like your approach and an accurate articulating of what makes a great investor?
Those are two parts of it.
Okay. Right?
The other parts are you need to help the team recruit the very best team, because there's nothing that you can do at a company unless you have a great team. And then obviously setting up the company for success from a financial perspective. So not only funding the company in the right way at the beginning, but making sure that that venture partner or that firm knows how to bring in the best investors at that next stage of the company's maturity.
Well, Ken, this has been a great conversation. We can go for much longer, but we started with the team. We ended the note on the team. So really appreciate your time and looking forward to co-investing together in a deal in the security space, and appreciate your time.
That sounds great. Thanks a lot, Mo. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ken. Talk to you later.
That's a wrap. Tune in next week for another candid conversation on what makes a great VC investor with your host, the Kaufman Fellows.